Hi, Josh Beiser. This is a special message before the podcast you're about to hear. I have some bad news to report. The following cast you're about to listen to was recorded when Skype decided to adjust my audio settings without letting me know. And because of it, my voice was recorded using my webcam instead of my headset, which you should be hearing me right now. What that means is that not only are you going to be hearing background noise a lot more, but my voice is going to be heavily distorted. I really do apologize for that. I like to keep these casts to a level of quality, and this is going to be below that. Fortunately, I was able to catch it after two casts, but it's still two casts that are going to be messed up because of it. Anyway, just want to give you this brief announcement and to let you know what's going to happen. This problem should not happen again. I'm aware now of what the issue was, and I'll be sure to hopefully catch it if it ever happens again. Anyway, hope you enjoy the cast, regardless of the quality of my voice. Take care.
Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Beiser from GameWisdom.com, and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast, where we examine the art and science of games. We got a great cast for you tonight. First, joining me is my co-host and contributor to Game Wisdom, James Ellerby.
Hi, I'm the intern.
And our special guest this week, he is the co-owner of the site Three Moves Ahead, as well as a podcast guest there. They specialize in talking about strategy games and design. He's also the associate developer over at Paradox Software. Please welcome to the cast, Troy Goodfellow.
Hi, everyone. Glad to be here, I guess. It's been a long time since I've been interviewed about anything.
Yeah, I know. We used to, I think, play some games together, like, back in the day being, like, 5-6 years ago. But I think this is the first time we actually have had a chance to at least virtually sit down and talk.
I think so.
So, Troy, it's great to have you on tonight. Thanks so much for agreeing to be on and talk to us.
I hope I'm at least halfway interesting.
Well, we can always turn about anything into a conversation. James here has seen what can happen when we start talking. Like, we've went on some crazy tangents in the past.
Oh, yeah. Yes, we have.
But yeah, it's great to have you on, Troy. I've been wanting to have more talks about the strategy genre in general, just because of how much it has really shifted over the last 5-10 years. And I know on your end, both as a fan, as well as now working with Paradox, you've certainly seen that from your own standpoint.
Yeah, it's been an interesting, I guess, 5 or 6 years. I was a games journalist. I was a critic for a while, professional critic, wrote in pretty much every magazine that ended up being shut down I was in. I refuse to take all the blame for that. And then about, you know, 5 years ago, I moved into public relations. And at the same time, we've seen this strange growth in some parts of the strategy game genre. So I'm happy to answer any questions you might have and talk a little bit about, you know, how the stuff that I have seen, you know, from hosting the Three Moves Ahead podcast, the topics we talked about you know, in the early days of the podcast, you know, 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. And if we could revisit them today and have completely different discussions.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And again, I grew up reading a lot of your articles. I think you were in PC Gamer. Did you do Computer Gaming World too?
I did a little bit for Computer Gaming World. Computer Games Magazine was my first big platform. It was a great magazine based out of Vermont. Was formerly known as Computer Game Strategy Plus, and then it became Computer Games Magazine, where, you know, Steve Bauman was the editor there, and he was outstanding, and there were a lot of really great writers there. Tom Chick was there. Yeah. Bruce Garrick was there. There were a lot of really, really talented writers, and I was lucky to be a part of that. And then, yeah, I've written for CGW and PC Gamer. I had a column at PC Gamer pretty much up until the end. I had to get a real job. And for pretty much every site you can think of, I've written for The Escapist and GamePro, and I've never written for IGN. Probably the only big site I've never written for is IGN.
Oh, interesting. I know Dan Stapleton, I think, he moves on to IGN. I know he does a lot of their PC game stuff.
Yeah, he's their PC Games editor. That's Dan's job. And he was my editor at PC Gamer. He was one of the people who brought me on there.
Awesome.
So Dan and I go way back.
Mm-hmm. And I remember, I mean, I've had Tom on a few times in the cast. I'm still trying to get him on again. I know he's been very busy. He's been doing a lot of stuff on his end, growing Horde 3.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's also kind of funny is that we're sitting here talking about, like, a computer gaming world and PC Gamer, and I'm not sure, James, have you ever read those magazines?
I keep in mind, back like when I think in the early days, I have read like PC Gamer, a couple of them, not really big. Keep in mind, I've always been more of the console towards the console market, just because that was my availability. But yes, I have heard of PC Gamer and stuff. So.
That's good, because I know for like a lot of the younger audience and those people like listening, they probably have like no idea what computer gaming world is and all that. So I mean, that's just how crazy things can get with the game industry, how quickly things have moved along.
Yeah, I mean, it's print hasn't been really, really viable, I would think, for probably 10 years now, if not more. But I mean, we see this, how so many people are now moving towards, you know, video. Mm-hmm. And the role of the critic has changed enormously. Mm-hmm. The place of the reviewer has become kind of, I would argue, has been countered by Let's Players, overshadowed by the whole Let's Play community, which I think opens space for more critics and serious reviews. But you have an audience that is raised with reviews that are not critical, that are not any more than marketing cheerleading stuff for the most part, though there are, of course, some exceptions out there. So there's this weird shift, I think, going on in the media, especially the strategy game media, where we have more and more strategy games coming out constantly, and there's an audience for them. But you look at the bylines of, you look at the staffing of most gaming websites out there, very few of these prominent writers or staff writers have a history playing strategy games. Most of them do come up either the console side of things or through the FPS side of things or the indie commentary side of things. And this whole band, the strategy game stuff, which, while the genre was not popular for a long time, you didn't have a lot of writers dealing with that and engaging with the topics raised in strategy games or knowing how to evaluate them. It's very hard for things like Polygon, for example. I have a lot of friends who write at Polygon. It's very hard to do. You very rarely see a strategy game review at Polygon. Mm-hmm. When we got a Stellaris review there for Paradox, we were very, very happy because we did not think it would happen because they generally do not review strategy games. And they're not alone on that. I mean, GameSpot will find a freelancer and the review will be up a little bit late. But there are maybe a handful of really good strategy game critics out there who are writing, but you go to YouTube and Twitch, and you have no trouble finding people playing these games, talking about these games, often just Let's Playing them and just making it. I don't think it's a criticism. I think it's, you know, they're just playing them and talking about them, and occasionally people criticize them going in there, but you can't search it. There's no argument. There's no editing. It's playing with somebody talking over it. But sometimes you actually find some really good criticism out there as well, if you know where to look. Because these people could not find, there's no money in freelancing, and you're not going to get a staff position playing strategy games, but you can build a pretty decent video channel talking about strategy games. So I think that's kind of where the space, where the thing fits. I mean, Three Moves Ahead, when I started that, oh my God, 2009, I can't believe how old Three Moves Ahead is. It was mostly, when we did Three Moves Ahead, it was a way for Bruce and Tom and I to talk about our reviews mostly, or to engage with them in a more far-reaching discussion about, you know, issues and themes and the like. It was a support to our writing. But now there's so much less writing out there, and Bruce doesn't freelance anymore, and Tom just writes for his own site, and I don't write anymore. And, you know, there's Zachdy, of course. Rob Zachdy runs the podcast with me. It is more and more shifted over to being a place where people are expecting coverage of strategy games as well as discussion, which is quite an interesting shift, I think. And we can't cover everything. I have said many times when 3 Moves Ahead started, we could talk about every major strategy game that kind of came out that year very easily. We could, there might be like nine or 10 really important games, important strategy games, worthwhile strategy games in a year in 2009, 2010. Here we are in 2016 and we are flooded by the number of interesting games and we cannot talk about them all.
Definitely. And I mean, I'm saying that here with Game Wisdom. What you said a few minutes ago regarding trying to get like quality review, quality analysis going, that's one of the things I've been doing here, trying to look at things from a very critical, a very analytical point of view. And I think just like everyone else, I've also transitioned into the video side of things with the YouTube channel and the Twitch streaming. Mm-hmm. And with the strategy genre itself, I think you are right about that, Troy, that we really don't see, see it from like major sites, and even like the market itself seems to have shifted away from what we used to play, you know, Age of Empires, Rise of Nations, those types of games, to either the MOBA-oriented games or very fast-paced micro-style with StarCraft, and even what they did with Company of Heroes 2. Now, one thing that I thought was also interesting regarding reviewing it, that's another thing that is another like really big shift from where we've gone from, with the fact that it really has become a let's play YouTuber kind of feel. Like, you don't really see too many professional game reviewers these days. And again, I get to date myself. I remember back during the 90s and early 2000s where I read a lot of these magazines. And that was during like the heyday of print, just before the internet really took off.
Yeah, but even then, if you think, most of the people who wrote those reviews, they were freelancers, and most of them had full-time, most of them had other jobs. And that very few people have ever made a living as a freelancer in the games journalism market. I mean, Bruce was never a games journalist first. He was an investment banker and then a surgeon. And I was a teacher and a graduate student and all of these other things. You don't generally, the idea of the professional reviewer, I don't think it's any better. I think it might actually be even better now because there are more places that actually have staffing, that have budgets. You have, you know, the Vox-backed Polygon. You have, the Gawker-backed Kotaku. You have, of course, IGN, and you have GameSpot, and you have PC Gamer, and all the other future sites like Games Radar and the like. And you have independent sites like Rock Paper Shotgun, which is like still the number one place, I think, for PC gaming news and criticism. And what they've done, and they built that on their own. And it took them a while to actually make it turn around and make money, but you know, they pay their contributors. And they pay their staff, and it's a full-time job for people. So I think, you know, 15 years ago, there were just a bunch of magazines and maybe a few websites, that actually, you know, kept things going. Mm-hmm. You know, GameSpot, of course, has been around forever, as has IGN. But I think there's greater diversity now in places that pay. And there are, you know, ways for critics to support themselves by other means, because we have, you know, you have tip jars and PayPal, which isn't all that great. Patreon has been good for quite a few people. I know Three Moves Ahead, our Patreon, you know, we're bringing about $1,000 a month, which, you know, supports Rob and most importantly, our sound engineer, Michael, and allows us to kick money back to our other contributors who come on, many of whom are freelancers who don't have, you know, tons of money coming in. So it's a way for us to support these people. So there are better, I think there are other avenues for independent critics now, but it's very, very hard. It is not easy. It's never been easy. And especially now that it's almost a full-time job when you're a critic, because you're expected to be on social media all the time, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're supposed to be on Twitter and talking about the latest stupid thing that happened in the games industry, which sometimes I get too wrapped up in. I have to be careful what I can and cannot say because I do represent my company now. My tweets are not endorsed by my company, but I represent them. So I can't get into slap down social media, Twitter fights as much as I would love to sometimes. But, you know, there's a lot of good discussion going on there, but it does often mean that you are effectively on the clock.
Yeah, man. I'm definitely saying it on this end. Over like the last month or so, I've, with suggestions from people that I know, decided to do more with the social media side, you know, Facebook, Twitter, and it is exhausting. Again, I'm like one of the older guys. This wasn't around when I was younger. So being on there every day, checking things, constantly updating people about what's going on, it's just tiring work. And you're supposed to be playing, reviewing games. And for me, I also have to make videos too. Now, I think another point I wanted to bring up, actually, before I do that, I guess for you, James, as you've been helping me out here with Game Wisdom and getting more on the PR, the management side of things as well, what do you make of like how things are going today?
How things are going as far as like the state of the game industry today, or how things are going as far as like personal journalistic review of games?
I guess like from your end, like more like the journalistic side, like now you're starting to get sort of like a peek behind the curtains. As someone who's been more on the enthusiast side for the longest time, what are your thoughts, like sort of like how things are going with like the push towards social media, YouTubers, etc.?
I believe that there actually is a place for both. I believe that especially the social media and the YouTube community, more specifically the YouTube community, is for your audience, the people that are actually sitting down and playing the majority, you know what I mean? Your income of the income, you know what I mean? It's like, World of Warcraft puts out a new expansion. You have the YouTube community is going to go crazy with it. The Twitter feeds are going to be blowing up. I always believe that Twitter has that connection between, because Twitter is half YouTube and media and half reviewer and the people that are actually, you know, the people like you guys, ones that are actually the behind the scenes, the ones that are really separating video games from just child's play thing to actual analytical artwork and analytical industry. They both have their place, and as much as I will say that I think the paper print media is dying off. I do believe it's obvious that there are still a place for the written word online and with review sites, especially after working with people like you, Josh, and with Game Wisdom in general. It shows that there still is a place for that. And I think that as far as what that place is, I think, is still to be defined.
Okay. I guess for you, Troy, I think another part that I also want to bring up what you were saying earlier regarding, I guess, what people expect you to review and just the sheer volume of games that's coming out. That's another big thing that I know has really taken off. You said that Three Moves Ahead was started in 2009, I think?
Yep, 2009, February 2009.
Yeah, and I still remember back then, that was like just around the time as Steam was starting to really get big. I think it was like 2007, 2009, somewhere in that area. And it's just insane to me to look at the volume of games we're getting. I have a post going up probably in a few days from when we're recording. Those of you listening to it should already be up, talking specifically about the indie market, but yeah, you just really can't keep up. Like, one person cannot look at every game that's being released these days. But again, like 10, 15 years ago, when you were only getting maybe one or two games out a month, or if you were focusing on a specific genre, you had that time to focus on one game and, you know, wait like a few months until the next one. But we really just don't have that luxury anymore.
No, it's. I mean, I kind of wish I had more time. There's so many games I would love to play. But I mean, Steam started in 2003.
Yeah.
But when it started, it was pretty much just Valve stuff.
Yeah.
For the longest time, it wasn't seen as this, as the place you bought PC games. You bought your PC games from the people who sold them to you, the people who made them. Yeah. They would sell them to you or through Amazon or whatever. There weren't many large portals where you could buy games, and Steam has slowly become, you know, the place, the Amazon of PC gaming. Now, there are exceptions. EA's got its thing, and Ubisoft wants to have its own thing, and other companies want to try this out. I think it's a good idea that Valve not have as not have a chokehold on the industry, especially since, you know, there's very little curation. They just put everything up there, which is good if you can't find a place to market your game or you're not good at the PR stuff. You can put your game on Steam and maybe you will get noticed, but maybe it will not. Have, you know, 15 new games coming out every Tuesday, and then, you know, a Steam sale comes and it bumps the new games off the front page because, hey, Steam sale, so all the big games now at the front again. So, yeah, hey, XCOM 70% off. That's your splash page, not the new releases, because that's how, because Steam's will making the money. They're not there to promote your game.
Yeah.
They will promote your game if you're selling it. Then you can, you know, if you can, because it's good for them. They're, you know, if a risky game sells well, hits certain targets, then you'll get a splash page up on Steam. And that's really, really awesome when it happens. You know, a company, we kind of cheer when it happens for Stellaris. When that came out, it was a really, really big day for us. It sold so well. But yeah, Steam is now the place where you buy all of your PC games, and it's got everything, and it started adding back catalogs of games. So it's kind of like GOG.com in some aspects. You can get the original Sid Meier's Pirates. You can get, you know, Age of Empires 2. You can get all of these older, you can get F-19 Flight Simulator, another great Sid Meier game, another great MicroProse game. Why are they here? Why are these on Steam? I'm glad they're here because people can find them, and that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And people have, if it's on Steam, people are more likely to play it. I mean, if we had, I know that if, when Paradox moved to Steam, a few years ago, it was a really big advantage for us as a company.
Oh, yeah. Definitely with that. Again, like growing up and looking at PC games before the rise of Steam, and as you just said, Troy, back in 2003, Steam was just practically Valve's little launch platform. There was nothing else there. And a lot of people looked at it and thought, you know, this would never work. Who wanted to have their games attached to one account? And of course, we were all just woefully wrong. But with PC games, there's always been a lot of hurdles to play a game on the PC versus a game on the console. And for you, James, as someone who's stuck to the consoles for the most part, I think this is one that you probably have had the fortune to avoid. But for a lot of PC games, as you just said, Troy, regarding everyone having their own website, being able to buy games from there, there is always that major pain in the ass of having to find the game, you have to find the person's site. If they release any updates for you, have to dig around for that. Hopefully find a downloading port that isn't, you know, a corrupt or has a virus. And you would have to do that for every one of your games. So it's just a big mess. And Steam, I think, has really removed as many barriers as it could for someone to play your game. I mean, I always go back to this example, but I mean, in today's world, I can spend 2 minutes, find a game on Steam that I want, give them my credit card, it's mine, it's starting to download. I don't need to go to a store, I don't need to search websites, I don't need to worry about putting my credit card information on some guy's random site. I have this massive thing that I can trust, and it really has just affected the state of the game industry.
I would think that, I mean, I would argue that Valve opening up Steam to third-party developers is most responsible for the revival of PC gaming very easily, because it's not like there wasn't PC gaming happening between 1995 and 2005. There was a lot of PC gaming going on, but most PC games were still sold in boxes. Mm-hmm. They would if you ordered it from Amazon, it would come to you in a box with a paper manual in a CD jewel case, and you'd pop it into your CD drive and you'd play it. But the brick and mortar sellers, the Walmarts, the GameStops, they were console heavy and console focused. So the assumption was this is what the gaming industry is, because that's what you saw when you went shopping. You wouldn't see, you know, Blitzkrieg 2 on for sale at a GameStop. You'd see a little corner of PC games, and it would have the most popular ones. You know, you'd see the ones that were also on console. You'd see the Civilizations, and you'd see the Sims games.
Warcraft and stuff like that.
And all of these, they were there, and that was, but by opening up to third parties, and all of a sudden these games are, as you say, they're really easy to install. They demonstrate how far the PC had come. Because I think the second most important thing is, you know, Windows 95, which for even though it was before the revival of PC gaming, the fact that that was the first platform that was pretty much plug and play for a Windows system. You know, I remember I was talking to my best friend, over the weekend, and we were reminiscing about, you know, how much we learned playing with DOS games.
Oh, goodness.
And selling IRQ conflicts and all of these things that, I mean, she's 10 years younger than I am, but, you know, she was always nerdier. So she remembers doing all of this. And I remember doing this and in college. And the fact that Steam was able to sell these games easily and remind people, hey, games work on the PC now. And you have a PC because you need one for work or for school. So now you can play games on it. I think has really, and for strategy games especially, because strategy games always had the hardest time getting onto store game store shelves. Unless you were a Civilization or an Age of Empires, you were not going to get on a store, or Total War. You were not going to get on a store shelf. But all, you know, all these look weird little RTSs, you know, the games like, I would think, I mean, it took forever for the Dominions games to get on Steam. If the Dominions games, Dominions 3 had been on Steam when it came out, I think it would have been a much bigger hit. Dominions 4 came out on Steam pretty much automatically. And I know a lot of people, I know more people are playing Dominions 4 than who played Dominions 3. I think Steam has a lot to do with that.
With that one, I remember, I mean, you talked about Bruce Garrett a few minutes ago. I remember, like, the first time I found was he wrote, like, a strategy or a new player's guide for, I think it was either Dominions 1 or 2. And that was, like, the only way I was able to even get halfway into that game.
And then he wrote the manual for 3, and I think maybe 4 as well, but I know he did 3 for sure, which I think is one of my favorite manuals ever. It's Dominions is one of Bruce's little weird things.
I know Tom wrote, I think, the manual for Galactic Civilizations at one point, or Galaxy 2.
Galaxy 2, yes.
Yeah. Now, I think one of that's another, like, really funny thing. We just had, like, a little conversation about DOS. So I got to ask, James, do you know what we're talking about when we're talking about DOS and that era?
It sounds familiar. I know I've heard it before, but, like, it's, like, well, and most of that is more just because of my... My early days of the computer, of playing computer games, were like finding those websites, like free games on websites. And you could play a game, you could play games on those kind of websites and stuff. I think the earliest computer game I ever played was the ski drift. You ever play that? The ski drift? It's the one where you're sliding down the slopes and then you get,
I think I've heard of it.
And snowman comes out and eats you and stuff like that.
But
no, I have never played that.
Oh, really? Oh wow. Yeah, that was an older game.
But the time of DOS and Windows 3.1, those were the pain in the ass times for the PC market. And you are definitely right, Troy, that the easeability of Steam, especially having that plug and play, soaring with Windows 95, now things have evolved, have definitely been key towards getting the PC market to stay viable. I think, like you, or I'm pretty sure like me, you've probably have read all those articles about how the PC was dying, the Xbox was going to be the new computer, and stuff like that. And thanks to Steam and Valve, things have just really took a 180.
Yeah, they have. And, you know, it's Paradox's CEO, Fred Wester, who I think is one of the most interesting men in the industry, he often talks about how years ago people tried to talk him into stop making PC games because it was not a viable place to publish games, that, you know, Paradox should move towards consoles if it wanted to keep making games at all. And, you know, being Fred, he said, I don't think so, and stuck with the PC. And I think, you know, Paradox has kind of reaped that fan loyalty to the platform. Though I don't I mean, I don't believe in platform loyalty. I think that's kind of ridiculous to be loyal to a game's platform of any sort. I think you've kind of limited yourself. But I mean, I play all my games on PC because it's comfortable for me. These are the games I want to play are on the PC. And the PC was never dead, but it was invisible.
Yeah.
And I think that was kind of, and it's, I think it's still in some ways, you know, invisible to large swaths of the game's criticism and the game's industry in general.
Mm-hmm.
Not like it once was, mm-hmm. For sure.
And I think that also goes back to sort of how the YouTuber and the Let's Plays have really risen in popularity. Because a lot of the YouTubers, they'll play these independent games. They'll play these little games that they can get in touch with developers. They can talk to them. I mean, someone like me, there's very little chance I'm going to email EA and get an interview with someone there. But if I email, like hell, if I email Tim Keenan from Misfits Act about Duskers, I can talk to him, I can get a copy of his game, and I can show that. And games like that get very little coverage. I should say they used to get very little coverage. And a lot of the big-name YouTubers really have risen thanks to basically being the first ones to spotlight these games. I know Markiplier got, I think, super famous for looking at Five Nights at Freddy's and being like one of like, the first people to do that.
Yeah, this kind of turned into a bit of a trap, though. Because a lot of YouTubers have got their start by playing these, you know, these smaller games and doing it very well and interestingly, but then they get captured by the machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
They become as the Xbox party at E3. There was an influencer's entrance. Because the big companies have noticed these people and the mid-sized companies have noticed these people and we send them their game. So now when a big game comes out, all of the YouTubers are playing the same thing.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the, you know, the charm and the value of the YouTube influencers as, you know, ways to expose people to new games has become, I think, devalued and become a way for people to watch others play the game you're going to be buying next week. They're playing it early and you can now watch them play XCOM a week early or play Stellaris a week early, or what have you. So YouTubers who are dedicated to that indie side of stuff, but many of the larger YouTubers have been captured, by the industry. And that's what's inevitably going to happen. It's going to happen, you know, I think happen very quickly with YouTubers because what they don't have most of the time is there's no editorial firewall, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no editor keep drawing a line between, you know, what you should or should not be doing, what the ethics are, whether you should take payments or not, what the FCC regulations are. I know some YouTubers have gotten into trouble with not saying, hey, this is a sponsored thing. I was paid to play this game, and they have to say that.
Yeah.
And if they don't, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Because they've become so popular so quickly, it was, you know, quite easy for in the, you know, the shine of you get to fly you out to LA and you get to play an Ubisoft game early.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, fun for them and, you know, fun for viewers. But it does mean that indie games once again have a discoverability problem.
Oh yeah.
And
Go ahead, finish your thought.
Nope.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with you completely on that, Troy. And that's something that we've spoken or I've had a lot of chance to talk to independent developers on these casts over the last 3 years. And that issue has definitely been prominent, and it could arguably have gotten worse these days thanks to the mobile market. We talked about Steam a few minutes ago, and pretty much if you don't do things right, or even if you do them right, your game can disappear off that front page within maybe 30 minutes to an hour of being released, and then how are people going to find you? And as you were just talking about with the YouTubers, with a lot of them focusing on larger games, and I've seen that with a few of the ones I've been looking around and, you know, taking notes on their channels, like, you see that they will focus on, like, one big game, you'll see, like, sponsored content or stuff like that, but it's getting harder to find people wanting to cover the independent games, unless there was that big scandal, I think it was, like, a year ago, as you were just saying, regarding people getting paid or asking for money to review these games and then not disclosing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, and there, like I said, there are people who are playing these games, but they aren't, you know, the they aren't the million subscribe YouTubers.
Yeah.
Those aren't the people who are going to be dedicating their time to, you know, really digging deep into a new Twine game, for example, or a game that hasn't already been discovered.
Yeah.
This is my big issue with a lot of indie coverage on, you know, mainstream sites. Something for indie games. We're not even an independent developer. Well, I guess we are technically, but we're not an indie. We're not. Paradox isn't what you would call an indie studio. Mm-hmm. But here I am speaking up for indies. So what was I saying? You have, I lost my train of thought. Yeah, there's one of my problems with a lot of the mainstream media, as they will only write about mainstream gaming press, is they will write about an independent game after everybody already knows about it.
Mm-hmm.
After it's already, you know, gone through its Reddit cycle, it's hit the front page of the gaming sites and it's been playing on YouTube for a few weeks, then they'll write about it. You don't have, you know, media going out looking for new cool things and saying, hey, look what I found.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing that YouTube Let's Play were really, really good at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people would find weird games and some of them just because they were weird and would play them. And that was great and fun and interesting. And maybe that moment's passed. Maybe it hasn't. Maybe we'll get back to the Garden of Eden or something, what have you. But they were stepping up in a place where a lot of the games media wasn't. Now they could always, when you have to count on page views, and you have limited space, you can always say, limited staff time, you can always say, look, we can only publish things we know people are interested in reading. But, you know, if your site's publishing 5 Destiny articles a week, maybe you can take some time and look for something else.
Mm-hmm.
As a strategy game critic, it was, you know, one of my jobs as a strategy game freelancer was to explain to my editor why this game should be reviewed. I remember Crispy Gamer, a site that I wrote for, excellent staff there. It was kind of the first Polygon type idea, you know, really, really talented writers mm-hmm. writing about games in intelligent ways. And then it kind of went off the rails once the VC got involved.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember I was reviewing Vic Davis's Solium Infernum, which I'm sure some people out there may have heard of. And if you haven't, it's this really weird, small, independent game where you are it's a turn-based strategy game, best played in multiplayer, mm-hmm. played by email, where you are a prince of hell trying to take over the place. So you cast spells and blights and you call down angels to smite your enemies, and there's bargaining and raising of armies and all of this stuff. And it's a really, really weird game that needed some criticism.
Yeah.
It needed to be, you know, it needed to be written about. But I had to really justify to my editor why this game was worth 1,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
Why it was worth paying me $X to write about a game that most people would never play because they would never find people to play it. The manual was ridiculously complicated.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was.
And the game wasn't easy to play, but that's kind of what Vic Davis's games kind of were. Armageddon Empire was kind of the same way. Six Gun Saga, I think, was easier to play and was pretty good. But Solium Infernum was this majestic piece of junk culture, as it was it was Dante's Inferno with rules attached and a bit of Machiavelli and Paradise Lost and all of these things and calling into, it was this meaty, meaty thing.
Mm-hmm.
But to review it, of course, to go to this site, which was still, you know, focusing heavily on, you know, major games and writing critically about them, I had to really fight for this review. And Elise, to her credit, you know, she gave me the space for it. And I wrote the review and it was, you know, well received, I think, except for one person who was really angry because I said something in the opening paragraph and I did not justify it in the rest of the review because he forgot to click page 2. Always click page 2, guys.
Yeah.
But this is a problem. I think it's still a problem with a lot of places. And I think it's a problem that a lot of YouTubers have run into is justifying to themselves why they're playing the games they're playing. Now, if you're in the strategy game space and you're someone like Quill18, for example, Martin Glow at Quill18, who he made his name pretty much playing Paradox games.
Mm-hmm.
So he's never going to stop playing Paradox games. But he's also going to take time to be flown down to play Forza because they'll pay him to come down and play Forza because he's a really, really good guy with a good audience, and he'll do his Forza videos, and then he'll come back and do a week of Hearts of Iron. And I really, I like working with him, and I like his, on the PR side, I really like working with Martin. I think he's one of the, he's, you know, very upfront with what he can and cannot do and will not do. And he's got his audience, and his audience likes those things. Other YouTubers have not been as dedicated to their starting things. They didn't really have a brand. But if you come with a strong brand, you can stick with it. I would like to see YouTubers, I like to see YouTube criticism go to the next level, and that's move towards edited video, proper edited criticism of stuff. Because you see this in, you see this in film criticism online, where people cut together different clips to demonstrate the points they are making. Let's Plays can't do that. You can't make a criticism of something unless you're sure it's going to happen on the screen. And it might not happen on the screen. Might not when you're playing it. This is why edited video and edited scripted video criticism is the next level for YouTube criticism. The problem is this takes freaking forever.
Yes, so to say that.
It takes a lot of time to cut the video. I mean, Bruce does some, Bruce Garrick does board game criticism, board game criticism on his channel. And he and I did some stuff. Last August, we played a bunch of board games at his place. And we shot some videos. One has been published. Because it takes so much time to do it.
Definitely. Yeah, and just really good points there, Troy, especially about Crypticon and Vic Davis. I love his games. I spoke with him. I think I was one of the few people to actually have a chance to sit down and talk with him. And it's impossible to find any coverage of his games because they are such a niche experience. It almost feels like he came out at the wrong time. Like his games were, was that like 2011, 2013, around there?
Armageddon Empires, I think, was 2009.
Ooh.
I have to look it up.
Yeah. And
well, no, it has to be before that because I was really because I was writing for Crispy Gamer, so I have to be way before that because Solemn Inferno would have been 2010. Solemn Inferno would have been 2010, 2009, 2010. Solemn Inferno.
Yep, and I would love to have done more with his games, but you're right. Like, finding the time to try and put something together is just very hard, especially when you're trying to grow something else, like what I have with the site and Twitch stream and all that. I do agree. I would love to see more, like, edit content, like, actual, like, edit criticisms on games. I would love to do that with, like, the YouTube channel here. I think that would be a great market. But again, finding the time to do that, it's just not in the cards unless, you know, I hit the lottery between now and the end of the month kind of thing.
Yeah, but then you still, you that gives you the, that money gives you the freedom, but not the time.
Yeah.
I mean, because a channel lives and grows by its traffic. And unless, you know, you can have a dedicated, constant stream of it, so people can go to your channel, it's never going to grow the audience. Now, if you're just interested in the criticism's sake, that's fine, that's great. You don't necessarily need to have a huge audience. That might not be what you're really interested in or able to just want, you just want to do it and get it out there. But yeah, I'm of the belief that good criticism should be seen and seen or read. Lindsay Ellis, who used to be in Channel Awesome, now has her own channel, she does... She did a really great, here's an example of what I think really great video criticism. She did a breakdown of the Phantom of the Opera movie. I know, it sounds stupid. It was a bad, bad movie. But it goes into more than just why it's a bad movie. It goes into questions of theme and camera work and how to make certain shots work. You know, how, why casting a non-singer works sometimes and not others. There's a really good, solid, it's an hour-long video, and it's solid edited criticism. And I just think it's the model of what we can do in the gaming space. Quite easily, not easily, but if there's kind of, we have this corpus of knowledge, right? We have, people say video games are a young medium. No, they're not. Stop saying that. Video games have been around for freaking ever now. And we don't really have, except in a few spaces, you know, the Boss Fight books do some of this. You know, have critics scattered throughout the internet doing interesting things. There's Occasionally on a popular site, you'll get someone like Austin Walker, who I think is some of the best young critic of his generation. You know, a Giant Bomb, it was great. He happened to bring some real criticism to Giant Bomb, which was outstanding to see. And now he's doing it. Now he'll be doing it as EIC Advice. We have this whole, we have like 30, 40 years of gaming history where we can talk intelligently about themes and about pacing and about art. Why don't we have any intelligent art criticism about games? Yeah. And it moves beyond graphics and talks about and beyond pixel art and whether pixel art is good or bad. You know, some really actually serious discussions about this. It is time to move to that place. We can't get there with Let's Plays, and we can get there a little bit with text, but they're called video games for a reason. The visuals are so important. And but we've seen through the rise of Let's Plays as how much people like seeing the game being played, how they respond to that. A criticism which shows the thing being played, I think, is quite valuable. I think, you know, I mean, the best that we have is, you know, is Sarkeesian's Feminism 101 stuff, which I think her videos are great and I think they're important, but you know, they're also targeted at a very low level because they're intended to be educational at a very low level. This isn't high level criticism, not intended to be high level criticism. That's not the market. And even then the videos are not especially well edited because a lot of it is the points. But that's, you know, the only prominent example I can think of a successful, widely distributed, edited video game criticism. And it is, you know, for a very specific educational purpose, targeting, you know, feminist criticism 101 level stuff, which is important and interesting, but video games are bigger than that and more than that. And we kind of need to have this, I think in the video criticism space. And it's a matter of having the time to do it and the money to do it and hoping an audience wants to see it. I always believe an audience will want to see it. And I think that the people who listen to Three Moves Ahead would respond to that pretty well. We have a pretty good audience.
Cool. We have so much to talk about. We have a lot of great discussions. Trying to think if there's anything we can talk real quick about more before moving on to our next topic. Yeah, I would love to see more. I know Extra Credits has really made a name for themselves with examining videos and doing stuff like that. That I would love to talk to those guys, but I know it's also like a pain to get a hold of them these days.
They do some really great stuff, but I mean, but again, their criticism is real. It's great, solid criticism. But again, it's not editing the video game. It's their cartoons and their chipmunk voices. It's cartoons and chipmunk voices, which is fine. And I love their work. They did some great stuff for Hearts of Iron. We had a sponsored video series with them. They did a great thing on the economy of the war. Check out those videos on Extra Credits or Extra History channel. I like their work they did for us quite a bit. Well, not for us, but we sponsor their videos because we like them. But you know, it's talking about the issue. It is an essay with cartoons.
Okay.
It's not really edited video in the way that I'm thinking about
it. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, and so far we've had a really great discussion, Troy, and I can tell that you didn't have anywhere to be after this. We would probably sit here and talk for like 2-3 hours easily.
And I am not that interested.
But there's just a lot of interesting topics to talk about. And we'll at least try to cover one of those today, and that's talking more about the strategy genre and where it's kind of gone to these days. Now, of course, you have your position at Paradox Software, and for those of you listening who haven't heard too much about Paradox, they really specialize with like grand strategy type games. These are the types of games that you can sit and spend easily like 10, 20 hours on a single play. Very complicated, very engrossing too. I know a lot of people who love the Europa Universal series, Crusader Kings, and even of course Stellaris. Now, Paradox is also really, as you were saying earlier in the cast, Troy, one of their biggest shifts was getting onto Steam. Another thing that they did was also embrace the DLC model with their games. These days, they release their core game, and then there is usually going to be at least a few dozen either like little DLC bits, and then, of course, their bigger expansions. I guess my first question I want to ask you, Troy, as someone who has been, I guess, you've been reviewing, you've been critiquing, you've been examining the strategy genre now for over a decade, from your own point of view, where do you see like how things have sort of moved to from where they were originally?
The State of the Union is strong but bored. I think the strategy game, there are more strategy games made now, as I already said, than there ever have been. Mm-hmm. And there are, and a lot of them are okay. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest change has not been a lot of change in. Mm-hmm. There's not been a lot of change in new mechanics, new approaches.
Yeah.
People talk about, wow, there's another 4X game coming out. Mm-hmm. Isn't that great? It's like, well, not necessarily, because, the new Master of Orion is just like every other space 4X mm-hmm. game. There's not a lot to distinguish it from the other Masters of Orion's games necessarily. So we have, and we see this through a lot of the genre, where there is a formula and people stick to it. I mean, here we have science fiction, the biggest, widest space imaginable for a strategy game. And yet everybody for the longest time, you look out there, they're still making Master of Orion games. Now, I will leave people to their own judgment if they think Stellaris fits in that model. I would say a little. But, there's not a lot of, the only company I think that's really done anything really interesting, for example, in the 4X space, has been Amplitude. Mm-hmm. With Endless Ledger, yeah. Which I think is, for many ways, just a genius game, because it's about cities, but also territories. It's about tactical combat, but also not. It has an interesting approach to a tech tree. Its diplomacy is interesting. The end game still doesn't quite work, in my opinion, but I don't care. Mm-hmm. I think Amplitude does really brave things. An Endless Legend. Like, for example, making factions that are so completely different from each other that you have to learn the game differently every single time you start a new faction, which is a huge penalty in learning the game. I'm not going to say this is necessarily the smart idea, but it's a brave idea.
Definitely.
I'm kind of iffy on. I think Endless Legend is, the most recent truly great strategy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's a really good point regarding the design. I mean, back during the, I would say, like mid-90s, early 2000s, while there weren't as many strategy games on the market, each franchise was really doing something differently, like StarCraft versus Age of Empires, or even like the difference between Age of Empires and then Age of Mythology, when they started adding in the hero units and basically threw in a fourth counter on the rock, paper, scissors formula. I'm trying to think all the time in my head about even like the turn-based strategy has some differences. I know Age of Wonders was really big back in the day. The last like turn-based game besides Endless Legend, I was thinking like that Eador, EADOR, that I think came out like a few years ago. But yeah, I agree with you, Troy, that in terms of like mechanically speaking, a lot of them do follow like similar formulas. It was one thing said.
But even Eador, I mean, that's Master of Magic. Mm-hmm. That's Divinity. I mean, that's what that game is.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the, you make a game like Master of Magic and you just change the name. That's kind of what Eador is. Mm-hmm. Which isn't a bad thing. I'm not saying these are bad games. There are a lot of good strategy games out there that are, following these paths. Also a lot of strategy games that are kind of getting lost. I mean, look at the Grey Goo, for example. Which I think is the last really truly great RTS is Grey Goo, and I think it's an outstanding strategy game. The challenging campaign follows along the StarCraft model, three distinct factions, one of which is a creepy type goo thing, which are kind of like their proto Zerg, and it's really an outstanding RTS. I wish I had more time to play it.
Yeah.
And what was the next game that the Petroglyph people did? 8-bit Armies.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a Command and Conquer type game, but with 8-bit-ish looking graphics. Mm-hmm. I look at, the guys who make, War Game, Yugen Systems, who did the War Game RTSs. Wonderful War Games. I like them a lot. I think Red Dragon, I think, isn't great because it has naval stuff, and naval stuff in strategy games is always a problem.
Yes.
I'm not sure how well they sold, though, because then they went back and did Active Aggression, which was a sort of a sequel to their Active War game from way, way back.
Yeah, and
it's a traditional RTS, except not good. So all these wonderful things they're doing in Wargame with a, in the Wargame system with, you know, historically accurate units. And even that was a step down from Ruse, which was their first game that studio did, which was a strategy card game about hidden information.
Yeah.
So brilliant. Wonderful idea. A lot. They moved on to the Wargame system, which was also great. You know, 1980s war with, you know, buying up units and play this RTS out in real time. Awesome. And they added the campaign elements. Really good. They must not have sold enough of them because they went back to doing a really not good RTS. Yeah. And, which I'm sure also did not sell very well because no one cares about active aggression or act of war. Yeah. There's just, we've seen this in the war game side of things for the longest time. The war game industry has the hardest time moving forward and developing, which is kind of weird to see that in the computer space, maybe because there's so much money involved. Because in the board game space, which is probably the most analogous to strategy games outside of the computer game space, I think it's more similar between board games and strategy games than between strategy games and Doom. It's just there's more money involved.
Yeah.
That, you know, this is where there's a lot of fun things happening in the board game space. About, you know, how do you sequence turns? How do you send information? How do you hide information? What are your values? What are your goals? Can it be where's the cooperative space? We have cooperative space. We have Rob Davio's legacy games where things are permanent. You know, you break the world. And the first session you play, your board stays like that forever. You know, this is like, these are things that are interesting. Yeah. There's nothing really analogous, even as strategy games bring in more board game elements. There's no analogous fertile minds, bring in really, really new ideas. You look at, the Civ 6, for example. I love Firaxis and I know I'm going to spend 2000 hours on Civ 6. And you look at what their big design ideas are, and they are each hex around a city can now support a building. Well, we've seen that. That's Endless Legend, and that's Warlock. I mean, that's a great idea, but you know, it's not necessarily your idea. They have the idea that they'll have will develop differently based on where they're at. That's interesting. We get to see how that works. But you know, there's, we're still looking for that next big breakthrough, and the next big breakthrough is not going to come from a franchise, but so much of the strategy money goes to franchises.
Yeah.
It's the Total Wars, it's the Civs, it's the Paradox games.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the three titans of the strategy space and the RTS space. People watch StarCraft. I'm not sure how many people. They may even play StarCraft, but it's not exactly a huge seller or cultural mover it once was.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine a Warcraft 4 RTS coming out these days?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You actually saw a lot of really good points in the last 5 minutes, Troy. But I have to try and digest. One thing that I thought was really interesting regarding how different strategy games really are trying the lack of pushing in new directions. And I agree with you. I've been watching those games like Ruse. I enjoyed Ruse. War Game was one of those games that it was very hard for me to get into. And with Grey Goo, I actually bought that. I haven't had a chance to sit down and install it, but you're the second person I've heard who said that was a really good strategy game. Now, I think one of the things that is really telling about the strategy more and how I agree with you that it isn't really moving in like unique directions is that it has always been a really hard sell. Even back during its heyday of the mid-90s, early 2000s, with the PC market, a lot of people played the first-person shooters and then went to the MMO. And even the console market has never really found a strategy game that truly worked for it. And I'm going to have to sneeze or blow my nose on one second. Oh, allergies. Okay. 3, 2, 1. Like, with a console, for instance, I can only think of a handful of strategy games that made it onto the consoles, like Battle for Middle Earth, and even XCOM Enemy Unknown, and XCOM 2, I think is supposedly going to be on the consoles these days. But the strategy genre has always been a really hard sale. And part of it, I think, is that uniqueness. The games that you just brought, Troy, Active Aggression, Ruse, War Game, and Grey Goo, each one of those games has completely different mechanics and systems. There's very little, I think, transfer of knowledge or skills between strategy games, not in the same way as it is with a first-person shooter. Yes, Call of Duty and Doom are two different games. They have two different feels to them, but you can at least take some of the things you know about control, movement, and aiming, and that is sort of translated between the two. But you can't say that just because you learn Civilization 4, that means you're going to master Europa Universalis. It's never going to happen like that.
No, I mean, there is some common grammar, but it's, you know, in the interface stuff. Yeah. Left select, right move. I mean, that's common. That's grammar. And any game that doesn't do that, I think, is breaking the rules of games grammar and should be taken up behind the woods and shot. But yeah, I mean, there are skills that do transfer. I mean, they're not necessarily the practical game skills. You know, you can't necessarily move your skills from one game to the next, but the skills that do transfer are things like being able to recognize a cause and effect.
Yeah.
Being able to anticipate and plan ahead. These are things that being able to, you know, think three moves ahead, being able to set priorities, and planning. These are really games about, you know, big grand strategies about logistics and planning. RTSs, being really, they're about economics. They're about where you get the best bang for your buck.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think, you know, people have often said, oh, real-time strategy games aren't really strategy games. No, they are really strategy games. Mm-hmm. And they often have the exact same strategy, which is how do I get the most power for the least amount of gold, mm-hmm. crystal, phosphine gas, or whatever. But I mean, that's the skill that transfers across the genre. It is the thinking ahead, the being able to recognize when you're getting a good deal and when you're not getting a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, that takes a lot of time. I know moving between civs, but I was really, really good at Civ 3 and I was really, really good at Civ 4. Civ 5, I can't get past Prince.
Mm-hmm.
I can't get the deity level. I'm never going to get up to deity level. I can't say it's because I don't have the time, because I have like probably 1500 hours in Civ 5.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, I can't make that leap. I just cannot make, and I do not watch Let's Plays of Civ because it just takes too long.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't watch many Let's Plays in general, but especially not of really, really long games. So, yeah, their skills won't necessarily transfer from one to the next. I'm also an older man, and strategy games generally attract older audiences, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I know more militaristic war games especially attract veteran audiences mostly. So probably that's all another issue. People like the familiar. So people stick with, you know, stuff they know, franchises they know, and, you know, they know how Civ works. They know how Civ mechanics work. And if, you know, the next Master of Orion game is just like Mu and just like Civ in the same way, people already know how that works.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we do see Endless Legend being praised for its genius, but also it's never going to be a huge runaway hit because it does have that barrier to entry.
Yeah.
Because it does, not just does it change so much from other games, it changes so much from itself between sessions if you change factions,
mm-hmm.
Which I love, but I also resent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And going back to what you're saying with Civilization, that's always been a very fascinating series. It's probably, as you said, one of the big mainstays of the strategy genre. It's the one that even console gamers recognize. It's just hit that mass of pop culture acceptance. I remember, like, every time there's a new Civ game out, it gets massive appeal, massive knowledge. But, like you, I find that they just have fallen into like almost like the same old routine, even though with each game, usually the lead developer on the project changes things up in some way, shape, or form. With Civ, I was the one hex per unit rule. Oh, were you about to say something?
No.
Okay. And like with Civ 6, like I just have gotten tired of the Civilization series. Like, unless I get like on discount, I just don't find those games all that interesting just because I find the basic gameplay just hasn't really evolved. And as you said, when you talk about these major franchises, you're not going to see those deviations on such a extent.
And there you will see some, I mean, even within the Civ series, mm-hmm. I would think, you know, Civ 4 and Civ 5 made huge changes compared to 1, 2, and 3. But I mean, it's still recognizably a Civ game because it has to be recognizably a Civ game. You can't take Civilization and, you know, make it real time. Though the original design for Civilization 4 was simultaneous turns.
Mm-hmm.
And then Soren decided that did not work. But in multiplayer, Civ 4 is simultaneous turns.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that does stick around a bit. So, you know, they do, sometimes they try to mess around a bit. But it's, you know, it's always on the edges because it has to be because mm-hmm. it is a franchise.
Yeah.
You're not going to have, I mean, Assassin's Creed isn't going to turn into a match three puzzle. Even if it's the best match three puzzle in the world, that's just not why people are coming for in Assassin's Creed. So I'm not looking for grand innovations, you know, within a series necessarily. I mean, small innovations here and there are to be expected. I look at all the changes that Paradox made between Europa Universalis 3 and 4. Dramatic, huge changes within the Europa Universalis world. If you were to go to your average person on the street, they would immediately recognize both games as fundamentally the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But within our community, for a while, there was even a debate over, you know, what should have been kept and what should have not been kept. So
definitely. I know we are starting to run out of time, and there is one question I really want to ask you about. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure if we had more time, this could be like an hour-long discussion as it is. But as we said for the last few minutes, there have been a lot of strategy games that come out. And even though the basic DNA has stayed the same for the most part, there are, of course, examples of great strategy games and examples of poor strategy games. And I mean, even with the Paradox Software games, there are some of the most complicated games out there. I know there are fans who dig into every little aspect of those titles. So my question for you, Troy, again, as someone who has been a critic of the strategy genre and examined these games inside and out, this is one of those questions, if we had time, this could be an hour-long one, but what do you think makes a good strategy game versus a poor strategy game? And I know that is such an open-ended.
I cannot answer that. because, I mean, a good strategy game has to, as a computer opponent, the computer opponent has to know the rules of the game it's playing.
Mm-hmm.
It has to know what a win condition is. And it has to do its best to get that win condition. With, you know, notwithstanding the issues of difficulty and et cetera. Sometimes that might mean you give the AI more information, sometimes more resources, but whatever. It has to know how to win and how to deploy its resources to win. That's an essential for what's a good strategy game. I would argue that if you don't do that, you're really not necessarily a strategy game. But I think the most important thing is the player should have either a clear goal in mind, clear objective, or be presented with a series of objectives, all of which are interesting. I mean, but that's a really hard question to answer because I don't want to say the win conditions have to look like this. Mm-hmm. What's a win condition in Crusader Kings 2?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is, it mean if you're the multiplayer strategy game or a online perpetual world strategy game, there really aren't any hard and fast rules. What makes a good one, what makes a bad one? What makes a bad one are usually just, you know, bad interface, unclear instructions, messes. But if it's a mess that's interesting to explore, I mean, a lot of games have, you know, bad UIs that are actually good games. So Solium Infernum, for example. Mm-hmm. Was an interesting role to explore. It makes you want to dig in. And I think that's, you know, kind of an important thing in a strategy game. It should be open to experimentation. It should not be able to be solved in the first 30 minutes of play.
mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that every strategy game has to have, you know, 2,000 hours on my Steam account. I'm fine with strategy games that have short lifespans. I'm fine with strategy games that have, you know, limited campaigns and you play them and you're done. I'm fine with that as well. But they should not be the type of thing you finish in 30 minutes and you put away because you solved it.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, the best strategy games are never solved.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the internet. There's enough people here who will just brute force it. And I'll put all the answers on a wiki for you and ruin your day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a really good lead-in to at least talking for like a minute or two about Paradox Software. Their games are just so immense in terms of trying to learn them, especially for new players like myself. I've yet to find one game for Paradox Software that I've managed to get into. And like you, Troy, I don't watch too many Let's Plays. I think my record was attempting to watch 2 hours of someone explaining Crusader Kings 2. And it just, you know, went in one ear out the other. So I think my final question for you, and again, we could sit here and talk for another hour, but at least for me, with the Paradox Software games, for like new players, like, do you have like any like tips or any ways like to like explain how these games are supposed to be played?
The wiki isn't a bad place to start. The official wiki, actually pretty decent. For at least his explaining things. I know for Hearts of Iron 4, I wrote about a beginner's guide for the media to teach them how to play it. Our games are getting better at it, but yeah, Crusader Kings 2 is really, really hard. it's not as hard as it once was because we've done some things to make it a little bit easier. For example, now when you're starting with Crusader Kings 2 and you've picked your country who you're playing, a splash screen shows up telling you what you are and are not allowed to do based on who you are playing. Mm-hmm. Like, here are the rules of you're playing an Islamic ruler. Here are the things you need to think about. Mm-hmm. Or you're playing a Orthodox ruler. So here are the things you need to think about. This is relatively new, to the Crusader Kings 2. Yeah, there are some decent, tutorials out there, but the problem with YouTube tutorials is how quickly they go to date. And Crusader Kings 2 is very old, and has been updated so many times that it's most of your tutorials are going to be out of date. I mean, one of my dream projects is to, you know, just get a month off, and I will write a starter's guide for Crusader for Europa Universalis 4, and then maybe Crusader Kings 2, EU4, because it's my favorite of pretty much my favorite game ever is EU4.
Yeah, if you ever get to write that, send it over my way because I could use it.
Yeah, I mean, people have asked me for it, and I keep thinking about doing it. And maybe I will when I have time, but I'm not going to be spending my summer vacation writing if I can help it.
All right. I mean, again, we could sit here and just blab about the strategy, John, for like the next hour, but I know you have to get going in the next few minutes. And James, I know this is probably this is like the least amount of time you've been talking on these casts. I think it's just been us old guys talking for the last hour.
It's fine. You learn a lot from people who've been in the industry for a while. So.
Great. To wrap the cast, or at least wrap things up right now, Troy, I guess a few final general questions then. Are there any strategy games in particular, or even just games in general, that you're really excited about that's coming out in like next few months or whatever?
No. I don't pay much attention to schedule. At least when a game comes out, I'm surprised anybody else. Mm-hmm. I often think about our own schedules. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's nothing I'm really, really anticipating beyond, you know, Civ 6. Mm-hmm. Because I know I'm going to be playing that forever. But no, there's really nothing in particular that's leaping out. I don't have a Steam watch list or anything. And when a game comes out, it's a nice treat.
Yeah, I get most of my information from the forums I visit, Quarter 3, or forums, stuff like that. But other than that, I just pretty much just wait around for games to come out, and then it's like, oh, look, it's out. Surprise. Because I find the other avenue, just having a game waiting, you know, months and months for it, is just killing me. Like, I'm still buying my time for Clockwork Empires to get done. And
It's coming along.
It'll be at some point.
I've been playing it. I've got a bunch of hours in it. I'm in the beta. It's coming along.
Yeah. let me see. Yeah, I think with that, we'll probably wrap things up. I know we didn't get to talk too much about Paradox Software and things from like that business side, but I know that wasn't your role here today. But I would love to either have you or someone from Paradox on for like a future cast. So I would love to talk more about how Paradox Software has really adapted and grew with the game industry.
Well, it's Paradox Interactive. And we've grown ridiculously fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely love to talk to you guys more in like an official point of view, maybe in a future cast.
We can think about it.
Awesome. All right. With all that said, I think it's time to wrap things up. Again, a lot of great topics we talked about and a lot of things we could spend 2-3 hours on. I think it's great that for like first time in a while, I think we're all on the same time zone. But I'm sure, Troy, you definitely have to get going. I think we all have to have dinner at some point tonight.
Yes.
So I will let you go for now. Troy, it was a pleasure talking to you. And like I said, I would definitely love not just to talk to you more about, like, from a Paradox Interactive standpoint, but have another, like, general, like, game industry or game design conversation as well.
Sure.
All right. And, James, it was great having you on. I know, again, you didn't get a chance to do too much talking, but I'm sure this was very informative for you, especially as someone making that transition from enthusiast to having more knowledge about the game industry.
Yes, definitely. It was a very much of an eye-opener, too.
Great. And for those of you listening, be sure to check out Three Moves Ahead. That is Troy's site. When do you – I know you guys do podcasts. Are you on a
That's all Three Moves Ahead is. It's just a podcast.
Okay, it's all just a podcast. All right. Didn't you used to write – I remember you used to make like some really big pieces on there.
No, it's for Flash of Steel. That's my blog, Flash of Steel.
Okay, got it. It's been too long. We didn't catch up. But yeah, check out Three Moves Ahead. When do you normally put up your podcasts?
They usually go up on Thursday nights, but this one's will be going up a little late, I think. It's been a lot of summer scheduling issues. But they usually go up on Thursday nights.
Cool. All right. So with all that said, we're going to end things here for this week's episode of Other Sets of Podcasts. If you'd like to support GameWisdom, we will, of course, have multiple options available. To write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. If you're a student, enthusiast, developer, as long as you're interested in talking about game design in the industry, I would love to have you on. To contribute to the Patreon campaign, just like Three Moves Ahead, we are doing a Patreon campaign to get the monthly funding I need to keep going. You can find that information on the Patreon banner on the front page or simply searching for Game Wisdom on Patreon. Your donations will be able to keep the site going, get you some cool stuff, and if we can hit some of those goals, it'll add more great content for you to enjoy here. Be sure to follow me on Twitter under GW Bicer to get the latest updates when content goes live, as well as thoughts from me throughout the day. Check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel and Twitch stream. Both should have links on the front page. There you'll find my variety of video-based content. While I don't have any edited videos, I do have plenty of Let's Plays and examinations. So again, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Be sure to check back next week for more great content. Anyway, have a great rest of the week. See you all then.